On Tuesday, 9th October 2012, it will be 50 years since Uganda got its independence from Britain when Sir Frederick Edward Mutesa II became the first president of the Republic of Uganda after Dr. Apollo Milton Obote was sworn in as his prime minister on 9th October 1962. It has been a long journey that has seen Ugandans go through a lot of political upheaval as eight presidents came and went. Some even returned. Military action has been synonymous with the change of power in the country. An organization celebrating 50 years of Ugandan independence is upfront about the difficulties that have ensued in that country since it left the British colonial sphere. 50 years ago, it seemed as if most states in Africa gained their independence, some of them after centuries of being colonized by European countries. In those 50 years, what effects has independence had upon the citizens of those countries? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Well, the answer to that question is mixed, but looking at the post-colonial fortunes of three countries in particular will give us a fairly representative sample of the successes and failures of independence. Our guest is Crawford Young, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and author of The Post-Colonial State in Africa, 50 Years of Independence, published in 2012 by the University of Wisconsin Press.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
I was at a recent talk by former Senator Russ Feingold, and he mentioned that when he got on the African Subcommittee of the Foreign Relations Committee, he really had to undergo a rapid learning curve because he didn't know where many of the countries were. And he used that to show how misinformed, uninformed most Americans are when it comes to Africa. So before we turn to some, you know, specific examples of African countries that have undergone movements toward independence, can you say something in general about America's lack of information about Africa and the danger of approaching it as a solid block?
Well, the lack of information about Africa is not because we lack in our country any distinguished centers of African studies, including one on our campus, University of Wisconsin-Madison. But there are a number of others, and the development of a whole national network of such centers goes back to the 1950s, when African independence first came into view. However, Africa, for the large public, is more of a blank slate. There is, of course, the natural constituency of African Americans who have long had a special, or at least their leadership has had a long sense of special connection to the continent in different ways, and has been very engaged in African issues. So the lack of information that Senator Feingold refers to, I think, is above all perhaps a absence of a sense of context and background for the kind of specific African crises that from time to time emerge and reach the first front pages of the newspapers, television programs, and so forth, as, for example, Somali crisis beginning in 1991, or more recently, the crisis in Mali, or the Arab Spring, so forth. All of these things, for the average American, lack a kind of historical background and context into which one can fit the current events.
All of those countries, I mean, it really seemed as if, you know, the map of Africa that had been, what, all green or all pink, depending upon which country had the colony, it seemed as if it turned overnight there in the late 50s, early 60s, almost as if it happened too suddenly. Was there a turning point when it was realized that these countries were going to be having different futures?
Well, the arrival of independence was very swift, and if one goes back to 1945, the end of World War II, largely unanticipated by the major colonial powers. There was a sense that perhaps in a century or so, Africa might become independent. But no sense at all of urgency in the very first post-war years. By the 1950s, as active nationalist movements took form, acquired a following, were able to mobilize enough support to make it clear to the colonial powers that it was not going to be feasible to stick to the distant timetables they had initially envisaged. And so over the course of the 1950s, there was a rapidly foreshortening set of timetables, driven in part by the emergence of armed liberation movements, most notably in Algeria. And when the French discovered that even with 500,000 troops deployed, they could not they were not defeated, but they could not defeat and eliminate the insurgent, the armed liberation movement. So that, too, was a salutary lesson to most other colonial powers, that the only avenue was to seek some kind of accommodation with the nationalist movements and find a pathway to a negotiated independence, which was the main avenue for the achievement of independence, with 1960 as the symbolic big year when no less than 18 states became independent.
How many states total from the, you know, whenever the big crunch was, late 50s into the 60s?
Well, how many became independent
yes.
that period? Well, close to 40 became independent from the 1950s to the 1960s. Egypt had been nominally independent since 1922. South Africa, under exclusive white rule, had been independent since 1910. Ethiopia was only briefly occupied by Italians, 1935 to 41. Liberia had always been independent. But for the rest of them, it was roughly two-thirds of the 53 total, now 54 with South Sudan as a new country.
One of the countries I know we're going to talk in detail about is Congo, and I'm always reminded of the line from Marlowe in Conrad's Heart of Darkness, where he says, "This conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much." My understanding from Conrad and other authors is that the Belgians were among the worst in terms of their approach as colonialists. Is that accurate?
Well, I would add a nuance to that characterization. The early colonial history of the Congo was unique in that initially in 1885, when it came under alien rule officially, legally, internationally, it was not ruled by a state, but it was ruled personally by King Leopold II of Belgium. Now, King Leopold had a problem. He had inherited 900,000 square miles through his diplomatic cunning and various maneuvering, but there was no revenue source to occupy and dominate it. So he had recourse more than the other earlier colonial powers to massive atrocities to compel the indigenous populace to gather wild rubber, to deliver ivory and so forth, to provide sustenance. He had no interest in spending his personal fortune on the Congo. And it did, after a decade or so, start to yield a revenue flow for the king. But it also triggered an international campaign led by Edmund Morrill, the Congo Reform Association in Britain, recently the subject of a well-known book by one Adam Hochschild that uses this material to summarize the brutality of the early Congo regime. Now, after the international protest became so noisy by the first decade of the century that King Leopold and Belgium agreed to transfer authority to Belgium itself in 1908. Belgium did, once it was the country and not the king in charge, reform some of the worst abuses of the Leopold regime. And in other respects over the years, they created an exploitative, like all colonial states were, but effective administration that in certain respects by the 1950s had an excellent agricultural service, the best health service in Africa, and so forth. So although Belgium was very ineffective and short-sighted in its belated and failed effort to decolonize the Congo, in its later years, the Belgian rule was exploitative, yes, like all others, but still had its positive elements.
To what extent were the African countries, including the Congo, sort of political footballs for the superpowers during the Cold War?
Very much so. When Africa quite suddenly, as I mentioned, became independent around 1960, the two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, both were concerned to expand their own spheres of influence in Africa, partly preemptive. That is, for the U.S., there was a morbid fear of communist penetration in Africa, vastly exaggerated, but nonetheless really felt in the corridors of the State Department at the time. And on the other side, from a Soviet perspective, within the framework of their ideology, to save Africa from capitalist exploitation. So those two opposed motivations led both powers to compete for influence and over time create a certain number of client states that were aligned with one or the other.
So often it seems when you hear about movements of independence, there's this great elation and optimism at the beginning, followed by disillusion.
There was indeed. And Africa's independence around 1960 was accompanied by very high expectations, not only in Africa, but in the world at large. Africa was viewed as having excellent prospects for rapid economic growth. There had indeed in the immediate post-war years been a surge of prosperity like unlike any other moment in colonial history, when Africa was advancing economically very rapidly. And it was widely expected by the development economists of the day that that momentum would be maintained and even reinforced by independence. At one telling statistic, Korea at that time, by the experts, was regarded as a basket case with very poor prospects. And Ghana at the time had a higher GDP per capita than did South Korea. The last figure I've seen for 2000 showed South Korea 20 times the GDP, the per capita GDP of Ghana. And that's something that it's a figure that's, with variation, applicable on the continental scale, that the high hopes of 1960 by the late 1960s were beginning to be disappointed. By the 1980s, they were shattered by a decade of economic crisis and regression in Africa.
Well, I know that you've chosen three countries to represent during this conversation, three different outcomes for independent countries in Africa. And if we look at the Congo, how does it fall into this spectrum of disappointment that you've just described?
Well, Congo is very much a disappointment in that it has an enormous resource base and high economic potential and a very talented population. And yet a recent careful study of Congo suggested that if there were stable and competent governance between now and the year 2030, that the Congo might regain the level of average well-being of 1960. Now, that's a pretty shattering statistic,
yes, yes.
And is a measure of the cost of the unhappy political developments between 1960 and 2000.
In terms of corruption particular, or what is it that squandered the resources?
It was a several. There were, of course, in anything like this, a number of factors that were involved. Firstly, a failed decolonization that Belgium delayed until the late 1950s, feeling any urgency about decolonization. Then when they were suddenly faced with a nationalist mobilization, which they discovered they could not control, and their confidence was shattered by large-scale rioting in the capital city in January 1959, they felt that they became persuaded that their only hope of organizing some kind of transfer of power peacefully was to come to terms with the most extreme demands of their nationalist adversaries, which were for immediate independence. Thus, the Congo became independent with only a handful of university graduates out of the top 4,500 administrative posts, categories. There were only three at the moment of independence who were Congolese. Of 1,000 officers in the army, there were no Congolese. So the scheme was extraordinarily unrealistic, that the way the Congo was going to be decolonized was really after independence rather than before. That is, the almost entirely European bureaucracy, the wholly European officered army would be the backbone of the state, and the Congolese would have a set of parliamentarians and ministers and so forth, but who would be entirely dependent upon the European core of the of state power. What took everybody by surprise and unhinged the whole scheme was that 5 days after independence, the army mutinied against their European officers. The mutiny could not be controlled. The officers, for the most part, left. And in a wave of panic, most of the European civil servants also fled. Then, 11 days after independence, the richest province and the source of half of government revenue, Katanga, proclaimed its secession with Belgian support. And so within 11 days, the Congo was suddenly bereft of the core elements of any state, its administrative capacity, its ultimate coercive power, and its major revenue source.
And were its borders arbitrary? In other words, you know, was this a mixture of different languages and cultures that were put together in a country called Congo by outsiders? Or did it, I mean, is that part of the problem?
Well, in a sense, it's part of the problem, but it's part of an almost universal African problem that nearly all African states are very heterogeneous in terms of ethnic community and often religion. And in many respects, that has been less of a problem in Africa in general than had been feared. The borders were virtually all defined by Europeans, and in that sense, they're more artificial than perhaps any other region of the world. And yet, one curious fact is that until the separation of Sudan in last year, of southern Sudan, Africa's state system had remained entirely intact. And it not only remained intact, but in only a handful of cases was the state system per se really challenged. The governments were often challenged, but not the configuration of the states themselves for a number of reasons. There really is no viable alternative to the present set of boundaries, and people have to a surprising degree come to accept them and even embrace them as their accepted in a natural framework for political and social life.
So why the instability, the constant replacements of governments in Congo in particular?
Well, in Congo, the instability first arose out of the army mutiny and the collapse of the decolonization formula. Then, after 5 years of instability and civil war, with thanks in part to a major UN operation, the country was reunited, and in 1965, a military coup led by one Joseph Mobutu, as he was then known, later Mobutu Sese Seko. And initially, Mobutu was able to reunite the country effectively, stabilize the economy, and up until the early mid-70s, the Congo seemed to be on a pathway to prosperity and success. However, corruption entered the picture. Mobutu tried to rule the country as some kind of personal domain.
Back to Leopold.
In a way, actually, Leopold was often a reference point for some of the political language then in use. And Mobutu represented himself as some kind of godlike figure that was the incarnation of the nation that all Congolese were proclaimed to be Congolese, that members of his party at birth, that he intended to be a life president, that Mobutuism, a vague ideology that associated with him, was put in the Constitution as the official doctrine of the country. The speeches of Mobutu were said to have force of law. And so this extravagant personality cult combined with a mode of management of politics that increasingly depended upon the grant of personal favors, opportunities for corruption, and so forth, to a shifting set of supporters, of principal supporters, who were then kept on a short leash by the constant threat of being suddenly removed from their prebends, even thrown into prison for short times on corruption charges, which were always true. And so that became increasingly the whole basis of the Congolese political economy. And then by the later 1970s, and especially the 1980s, the system was sustained by Mobutu taking an ever-growing personal cut out of the major export items, the diamonds, the copper, and so forth. And increasingly, especially for the copper and cobalt, depriving the productive operator of the mines of the resources to maintain the infrastructure and so forth. So by the 1990s, you had hyperinflation, a drop of copper production from 450,000 tons to about 30,000 tons, a complete implosion of the economy. And it was in those circumstances that an insurgent group was finally able to overthrow Mobutu in 1997. But the damage to the economy and to the infrastructure of the state had been so great by that time that was even with substantial external assistance and a new UN operation and so forth, there has been political instability ever since, never completely overcome, and particularly in the eastern borderlands, consistent and ugly civil strife of different sorts.
Well, we'll find out if we have a different picture of success when we look at Uganda in just a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Crawford Young, who's filling us in on 50 years of independence, three case studies from Africa. We've looked at the Congo so far and found that that has been a disappointment in terms of serving the needs of the people, with an economic breakdown and corruption and a good deal of anarchy, it sounds like, too. That was a Belgian colony. Now if we look at a British one, one of several former British colonies in Africa, Uganda, what kind of picture do we get?
Well, we get a somewhat different picture in that Uganda started off very well. However, by the late 1960s, it was running into increasing difficulty. And in 1971, it experienced a military coup by a former non-commissioned officer, Juan Idi Amin, who was singularly unsuited to run a country. The Amin tyranny from 1971 to 1979 was a singularly destructive period, more so than any period in the Congo.
Why do you think he rose to power?
Well, because he was head of the army, and because the specific trigger of his coup appears to have been that the ruler, then ruler Juan Milton Obote, became increasingly apprehensive about Idi Amin. There was also conflict within between leading officers in the army, and that Idi Amin seems to have formed the conclusion that Obote intended to overthrow him and arrest him if he didn't act first. So he took advantage of Obote's travel to a Commonwealth conference in Singapore to step in and take over. But and initially, as has been the case in most coups in Africa in the first three decades of independence, the public disaffection from the incumbent regime was such that people celebrated and welcomed the coup. And so the first couple of years, it looked like Idi Amin had considerable support. However, as time went on and he began to face increasing opposition, and his response to opposition was increasingly tyrannical and brutal, And extreme measures like the massive expulsion of the 100,000 or so Asians in the country who were managers of most of the commerce dislocated the economy. And by the later 1970s, the country was in clear decline. It was finally Amin overreached. He was motivated to invade neighboring Tanzania, which led to the Tanzanian army invading Uganda and forcibly overthrowing Amin and facilitating the restoration of Milton Obote, who had been the prime minister and president earlier. But Obote, in his second coming, was not able to undo the damage of the Amin regime. And he, in turn, fell victim to another insurgent group led by Yoweri Museveni, the ruler who, since 1966, when he was able to conquer the capital and seize power, has been the president of Uganda.
What is the nominal government structure of Uganda?
Well, the nominal government structure is that it's a unitary state with, when it reached independence, some areas in the country, notably the area that gives the country its name, Buganda, a well-organized kingdom that had constituted about 20% of the population, was anxious to have its own autonomy. So a quasi-federal state was created. That was eliminated in the middle 1960s. And the monarchies in the southern part of the country were suppressed. Museveni was under a good deal of pressure to restore the monarchies. He accepted only their restoration as cultural entities and not as operative political units. So that's been an ongoing debate since 1986. So in practice, it's a relatively centralized state.
Is it a dictatorship, sort of? I mean, it sounds
well,
as if it's...
That's a matter of debate. Many Ugandans today would say, yes, it is a dictatorship. Museveni initially had, as many new regimes entering power, a good deal of legitimacy and support. And his first steps were to liberalize the economy with a good deal of outside help. The economy then began to reorganize itself, develop, and prosper. He organized a constitutional exercise that had very wide participation and created a new constitution with a rather unusual notion that he had what he called a no-party system, that his...
Heard of those.
That's right. That
his, hard to lose an election, then.
Insurgent movement, the National Resistance Front, which was, in, to all intents and purposes, a political party, called itself simply the incarnation of the Ugandan nation. And finally, in 2006, I think it was, the constitution, the Museveni constitution, was altered to recognize multi-parties, and the NRM became simply another political party. But a political party that has continued to hold power, as has Museveni, since 1986.
So is there a parliament of some kind?
I mean, yes, there is a parliament. And it is it's active. It has serious debates. It is a constraint on the system. My colleague, Eile Marie Tripp, who is a Ugandan specialist, calls it a hybrid state, a semi-authoritarian state. There is a meaningful parliament. There is an opposition press. There is a zone of respected civil rights and freedom of speech and so forth. But at the end of the day, Museveni does monopolize political power.
And what about the plan of succession? What happens after him?
After Museveni. Well, that's a matter of debate and expectation. The next elections are due about 2016, and there is some speculation that Museveni will finally step aside. He has, for the last two presidential elections, permitted serious opposition, and although has taken many steps to constrain the freedom of the campaign, the openness of the campaign. And there are those who think that Museveni may step aside and permit a genuine succession. Whether that will actually happen remains to be seen, because the habits of, well, really 50 years are fairly well established.
Not longer.
And if you had to compare and contrast Uganda with Congo, looking at these two examples of kind of a country that's moved since independence, what would you see as similarities and differences?
Well, the similarities are that, firstly, the countries have had their high and low points. The Congo had a high point from 1965 to the mid-70s, and then has come back a little bit since the overthrow of Mobutu. But the damage done to the Congo was so much greater than the damage Amin did to Uganda, that it was more possible for an effective and functioning government to be reestablished in Uganda, for the economy to be put back into working order, so that there is a not only a functioning state, but a modicum of prosperity. And Museveni is able to boast about the growth rates of his country and so forth, which are, you know, by and large true. So Uganda is a lot better off than the Congo today. That Amin didn't stay in power for 30 years as Mobutu did, and so there was not so prolonged a period of state destruction as occurred in Congo. Now, another parallel is that there have been, since the 1990s in particular, there have been serious civil wars in both countries. And Uganda has been, Museveni came to power, and this is a pattern that has been repeated in several countries, Chad, Rwanda, some others, where an army, an insurgent movement from the periphery of the country wins power at the center, and as a consequence, the existing armed forces disappear into the bush with their weapons.
And it's a little different from what we're used to, even in
exactly,
you know, and so extreme European or Asian countries.
And most of the soldiers are not interested in a farming career. They and their one resource is their military background knowledge and their weapons. And so they reform into new insurgent groups. So Uganda at one point had a couple of dozen under Museveni of small-scale insurgencies, and then one major one, the infamous Lord's Resistance Army, that was the subject of the famous Kony 2012 video that swept the country and excited so much interest. And it's been very persistent. I mean, it was formed in the late 1980s, and although it's been driven out of Uganda, there are a few hundred of them that still plague Central African Republic, Southern Sudan, and Congo.
It's almost as if these reconfiguring army groups, these kind of ad hoc organizations, are the closest approximation to political parties and electorates.
Except that the ones since the 1990s don't have very clear political agendas, if any. Firstly. Secondly, they are not necessarily seeking supporters. They're stealing from the people amongst whom they live. They survive by plunder. And so they're not creating a political clientele.
They're more interested in anarchy.
Yeah.
And if you travel to Congo and Uganda today, what are some of the vestiges of colonialism that you see that sort of tell you one was Belgian and one was British?
Well, those are fast eroding, because it is, after all, more than 50 years. And when you look back to 1960, if you go back 50 years to 1910, that's just the very beginning of colonial rule. So colonialism, in a longer historical perspective, was a meaningful, extremely important, but still a relatively brief episode in the life of the African states. What you would see is that the state infrastructure left behind by the British colonizer, which was by the 1950s a very capable and performing state apparatus, was never as thoroughly uprooted and destroyed as the state had been in Congo, nor rendered as incapable of providing basic services, doing the kinds of things that we all expect a state to do. But that doesn't particularly pertain to Belgians or British rule.
Well, we've looked at Congo, we've looked at Uganda, and we'll see if we can find a third state that might contrast with the rather unhappy stories that those have experienced in the last 50 years when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Crawford Young, whose new book is The Postcolonial State in Africa, 50 Years of Independence. We've talked about the Congo and about Uganda. Let's turn to a third example, Senegal. What can you tell us about its history?
Senegal was a French colony. It was one of the most administratively and to some extent economically developed of the sub-Saharan French possessions before 1960 during the colonial period.
This is west coast of Africa.
It's on the west coast of Africa. And it was the oldest French footfall in West Africa. It was the base from which what became the gigantic, sprawling French West Africa was originally constructed. So it had an unusually long period of French colonial rule and a quite large and talented intelligentsia had grown up amongst the Senegalese, larger than Congolese or Ugandan counterparts. During this very, very long colonial period. In contrast to Uganda and Congo, it has a relatively meager natural resource base. In colonial times, its economy was mainly based on peanuts. Peanuts may be good, but hardly
working
a serious basis for a truly prosperous economy, especially in post-colonial times. There's some other smallish kinds of things, phosphorus deposits and a potential for iron ore, and there's small amounts of offshore oil unexploited as yet. But it has had a difficult time creating a really prosperous economic base for itself. However, it has had a couple of major advantages that Uganda and Congo did not. It has had basic political stability throughout its post-colonial period, continuity in governance. It's had relatively able leadership, above all, the first president of Senegal, Leopold Senghor, was a quite remarkable figure, a philosopher, poet, as well as a politician. And he, in his two decades of rule, set Senegal on a basically positive course. Was a Christian ruling an overwhelmingly Muslim country. He was a master at building a consensus after going through his nearly all African states, a period in the 1960s of single party system, eliminating all opposition parties, he was one of the first to break out of that pattern as early as 1976 and permit opposition parties to really meaningfully exist. And so his leadership example was a very positive one. And it's no accident that of that generation of the first three decades of independence, relatively few ousted presidents could safely live in their own countries. but Senegal, Senghor, like Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, remains widely admired, not because all of his policies work well. He, like many other African leaders, was in the beginning an intellectual socialist and had high confidence in the capacity of the state to own, operate, manage the economy, that expectations, dreams that went beyond the real capacities of the states as they actually existed. But nobody much takes him to task for that now. They would agree that the dream was noble, even if its implementation was faulty and disappointing. And then he did accept, by 1980, adjustments in the pathway, and also agreed to step aside and facilitate the election of his primary deputy, Abdou Diouf, who also, in my estimation, not all Senegalese agree, was a very able leader who was not only a technocrat, but also a leader of basic decency who did not follow the path of highly repressive politics to stay in power.
Was the education level in Senegal higher than what you mentioned in the Congo, where so few had university educations?
The education level was quite high in Senegal, and it had one of the first sub-Saharan universities in Dakar, and Senghor laid the groundwork for the creation of a second major university. So it has a very solid base of well-educated elites to provide leadership for the country.
Now, is it an irony or some other phenomenon that says that you have a place like Congo that's resource-rich but can't hold a government together, and then you have a place like Senegal, relatively poor, but more stable.
More stable, partly, some people would say, because they don't have oil. It's,
right.
Oil has been widely...
Don't have to worry about greed so much if there's nothing to grab.
That's right. And so when, if governments could figure out a way, like Norway, to use the oil resource as a basis for developing the country, that would be one thing. But when it becomes a magnet for all kinds of operatives to, and indeed the sole source of enrichment for not only the political leaders, but anybody else, as is the case in places like Nigeria or Equatorial Guinea or Angola. So the relative absence of of high-value minerals has, in one might argue, in a certain sense, imposed a discipline upon the Senegalese state to do the best they can with the resource hand that has been dealt to them.
In the few minutes that we have left, what do you think are the lessons? If you look at post-colonial Africa, the many different stories of what's happened after independence, many different kinds of governments and leaders, what are the lessons?
Well, one lesson I think emerges from a glance at the relative performance of the 53 states is that stable, constitutional, rule of law government makes a very large difference. The two countries that were in 1960 at the base point for independence, regarded as the least promising in Africa, Botswana and Mauritius, are the only two that have had a constitutional government, multi-party systems, basic political freedoms preserved throughout their 50 years. And if you look at any of the tables that now proliferate, Transparency International, Corruption, Freedom House, Political Rights, the Mo Ibrahim Index of Governance, Human Development Indexes, those two rank right at the top that nobody would have predicted. Botswana had 12 kilometers of paved road at the moment of independence and a comparable number of university graduates to Congo. And yet, partly through stable, continuous constitutional government, partly through particularly able leadership and by the first Botswana leader, Tseretse Khama in particular, and his successors and their counterparts in Mauritius, those two stories, if you look at them closely, are quite different in their detail. But they stand out to my mind as exemplary narratives for Africa and to demonstrate that stable, constitutional, rule of law government that protects basic human rights and that is at the same time is grounded, authenticated by rooting in an African heritage are avenues which can provide a better future for Africa.
Our guest has been Crawford Young. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.